From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn why alcohol-related deaths have risen in Wisconsin and who has been most affected. We'll learn about a new program that's aimed at helping female farmers struggling with their mental health.
I've had this sort of lifelong concern for farmer mental health and trying to figure out how do we make it more acceptable to talk about mental health concerns and provide enough support in our small communities where there aren't mental health professionals.
Then we'll hear from food entrepreneurs from the Taste of Lindsay Heights Community Cafe as a part of our COVID Earners series.
We wanted to be a space that provided healthy, fresh foods for the residents who were now being affected by this virus. And then we also wanted to be an outlet and an incubator space for the entrepreneurs.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Deaths caused by alcohol are way up in Wisconsin. That's according to a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which found that alcohol-related deaths had an unprecedented spike in 2020, the most recent year that data is available. Lake Effect's Joy Powers spoke with two researchers from the forum, Ari Brown and Mark Sommerhauser, to learn more.
When you say alcohol deaths rose sharply in Wisconsin, what does that mean? How sharply are we talking about?
Yeah, so we looked at data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So these looked specifically at what's termed alcohol-induced deaths, which would include primarily items like alcoholic liver disease, mental and behavioral disorders due to alcohol use, and other sort of biological and physical diseases that come about from overusing alcohol. It does not include things like car crashes and any sort of violence that would come kind of as a side effect of using alcohol. It's only the deaths that are kind of directly due to the use of alcohol. But what we found was that from 2019 to 2020, in Wisconsin, there was a 24.5% increase from 865 deaths in 2019 to 1,077 in 2020. That rise mirrors very closely what was happening at a national level, where alcohol-induced deaths increased by 25.7%. At the same time, we looked all the way back, kind of going as far back as the data would take us, to 1999, and we found that while Wisconsin and the U.S. had similar per capita rates of death from alcohol-induced causes back in 1999, slowly over time, Wisconsin has kind of been rising at a swifter rate. So by 2020, the rate of death from alcohol-induced causes in Wisconsin was about 25% higher than the nationwide rate. So we really wanted to highlight with this research both the notion that there was a really swift increase in 2020, and an unprecedented one in these data, but additionally that this is kind of just the end of a string of a very concerning trend, which is a slowly increasing rise in the rate of alcohol-induced deaths.
When we look at the last year that I'm guessing data was available, which is 2020, with that really sharp rise, what are some of the factors that we can point to that really explain why things rose so sharply?
Yeah, so obviously with any sort of trend like this, there's going to be multiple factors, and we don't claim to have an exhaustive list or a complete list. A few things that would come to mind that we have taken a look at, we did some separate research about 5 months ago that found that alcohol buying and consumption did increase during the pandemic, both in Wisconsin and nationally. And I think it stands to reason that if more alcohol was being bought and consumed, that could have been a contributing factor to what was going on here. We know obviously stress and isolation can contribute to substance use and substance abuse. And I think it's just very widely understood that we've all been going through a lot of that since March of 2020. One thing that has really come up in some of the folks that we've talked to both for this report and since is just the possibility that, we know that healthcare providers were beginning to restrict a lot of their access to normal sort of preventative care and other procedures, especially early in the pandemic, that could have potentially played a role here, as well as people perhaps that were seeking other types of care, mental health care, substance abuse treatment. We know that was certainly curtailed and affected quite a bit by the pandemic, during the pandemic. And, we do think that it's certainly possible that could have been another contributing factor to what we saw in these data.
I think it's also worth kind of talking about over time why Wisconsin might be at a point now where it's lying pretty far above the nationwide rate for alcohol-induced deaths. We included in our report a number of studies from various sources that looked just at the fact that Wisconsin, both now and going back decades, is among the states with kind of a pretty high rate of binge drinking. We have a report from the UW Population Health Institute that found that across all age and gender groups that Wisconsin had a higher rate of binge drinking in 2019 than the nationwide rate. A CDC report from 2015 showed that Wisconsin had the second highest prevalence of binge drinking of any state. And then we have a third study that showed that every year from 1980 to 2009, when the study concluded, Wisconsin was in the top 10 states for per capita alcohol consumption. So really, these are all kind of signs that point to the fact that Wisconsin, you know, has a lot of citizens within the state who are consuming alcohol at very high rates. Within this report, we have this visual that kind of looks at the differential in alcohol-induced death rates among different age groups. And we find that the increase in Wisconsin is really being driven by those between the ages of 45 and 84. And this kind of tracks together, you know, if you think about those who are dying from alcohol consumption solely, in a lot of cases, it can take, you know, many years to compound that much alcohol use to the point where it's, you know, leading to death. So it makes some sense that with Wisconsin's high binge drinking rate and a rise in alcohol-induced deaths among middle-aged and older populations, that those two things kind of go together.
I don't think people will be surprised to hear that Wisconsin has a big drinking culture, but I do think people would be surprised to know who has been most impacted by the rise in alcohol deaths. You mentioned middle-aged Wisconsinites. What are some of the other groups that have been hardest hit inside of Wisconsin?
Yeah, so one of the other items that we looked at in this report was the rates of alcohol-induced deaths among various racial and ethnic groups. And kind of one of the more alarming findings from our report was that, you know, for the most part, deaths among the various racial and ethnic groups in Wisconsin track their counterparts at the national level, except when it comes to the rate of death for Black Wisconsinites. What we found was that, you know, nationwide, the rate of death for Black Americans from alcohol-induced causes has been below that of white Americans for most of the 21st century. In Wisconsin, that was mostly true for the first part of the 21st century, but since around 2012 or so, the rate of death for Black Wisconsinites has really been diverging from the rate of death for Black Americans in a really kind of alarming way, where the rate of death for Black Wisconsinites has been going way up. In 2019, the rate of death for Black Wisconsinites was above that for white Wisconsinites for the first time since 2005. It dipped back below in 2020, but the kind of trend there looks very different in Wisconsin versus the national rate. We note in our report, for example, that in 2020, the death rate for Black Wisconsinites was the fourth highest for any state's Black population, behind only Colorado, New Mexico, and Nebraska. So that was one of the kind of really alarming things that we found was, I think we were concerned because there isn't really a clear story there. We, you know, weren't really able to identify why that was going on. There are certainly structural factors that you could point to, but definitely we think it's an area where more research is needed.
Sure. I think people will hear this conversation and have, you know, perhaps the logical response of, what do we do with this information? What are some of the solutions to this problem? Are there policy solutions that can help ease this trend?
Yeah, so that's obviously probably the most important question that we can ask about this and something that we look into as a policy research organization. It's certainly not going to be an easy fix. And again, I don't think anybody's going to suggest that there's going to be one thing that we can do. You know, certainly in our research and our report, by the way, you know, again, does not pretend to have any sort of a conclusive or exhaustive list, but we did offer a few suggestions of a few things that turned up in our research as having had some effect, you know, in places that have either taken measures to curb access to alcohol or in some cases, have higher levels of alcohol taxation. Wisconsin has some of the lowest alcohol taxes in the country of any state. That can have an impact. At the same time, that is always politically fraught. It can be, you know, very unpopular, frankly, to do some of these things. So we kind of acknowledge that in our report. And we also suggest that potentially another step that policymakers might consider that might be more broadly popular and could potentially get more buy-in across the political spectrum might be to look at directing more resources toward some programs that can deal with prevention, substance abuse treatment, addiction treatment, these types of things that potentially at least could make a dent in this problem. So those are a few things that we touch on in our report. Again, not an exhaustive list, but just a few possibilities to hopefully get policymakers thinking about what the appropriate response might be.
Ari Brown is a researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and Mark Sommerhauser is the communications director and a policy researcher for the forum. They both join Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The pandemic put stress on a lot of working people, and Wisconsin farmers were some of the most greatly impacted. Farmers are among the most likely to die by suicide than any other occupation, according to the CDC. In addition to work-related stress, farmers often live in rural areas, which can lead to feelings of isolation and loneliness. A statewide collaboration is turning their focus to addressing those struggles, particularly among women farmers. Wisconsin Women in Conservation are launching a program this weekend designed to train women to recognize and respond to someone in need. Stephanie Schneider owns a farm near Eau Claire. She's one of the women who will go through this training, and Chris Frakes will be providing that training. They both spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. We would like to note for our listeners that this conversation addresses both suicide and addiction.
So I grew up in Iowa. My mom's side of the family were all farmers, row crops primarily. In my late teens, early adulthood, was living through the farm crisis with the rest of the country. And that really was impactful to me to see the kind of stress that created for my own family, family members who were farming. But then we also had a couple of suicides in our community. And, you know, like many small towns, when there's a tragedy like that, it really sort of shakes the core of the community. And so I've had this sort of lifelong concern for farmer mental health, and trying to figure out how do we make it more acceptable to talk about mental health concerns and provide enough support in our small communities where there aren't mental health professionals.
So Chris, you'll be leading this training, is that correct? And it's a model that's called COMET?
It's called COMET, which stands for Changing Our Mental and Emotional Trajectory. It's a program that was developed in the Eastern Plains of Colorado in a very rural communities by farmers and ranchers in conjunction with some researchers out at one of their universities to respond to the same kinds of things that we've been seeing in Wisconsin, right? That there aren't enough resources in our rural communities. There's a lot of stress, especially among farmers and ranchers due to, you know, all of the things, right? Market, supply chains, disruptions, climate change, the whole gambit. And so this program they developed in conjunction with farmers and ranchers to make sure that it was really going to be impactful for that audience and was speaking in language that was resonant with farmer and rancher experience. What it does is it teaches community members how to provide support, how to operationalize their noticing that somebody is stressed or struggling, and then to give them a set of steps that they can work through. So there are five basic steps you work through. Just to make gentle inquiries about how somebody's doing. And through that process, it's not asking people to become mini counselors or to fix anything. It's really teaching people the skills to do empathetic listening and just to hold a space where somebody can sort of talk about what is going on for them. And what they found through their research is it's that process of somebody providing undivided attention and letting you talk that really helps to reduce somebody's stress, right? It's not an appropriate training if you're really worried about somebody's having thoughts of suicide. We have other trainings that are other workshops that deal with that. This is really, I've noticed you're stressed or struggling. Let me put some support around you and see if we can head you back towards wellness instead of having you continue on towards crisis.
So Stephanie, how do you envision the value of this program?
I think this will be extremely valuable. I can always learn more conservation stuff. You know, that's pretty easy to do. There's a ton of tools and resources and things out there already to help you with conservation. But when it comes to dealing with people, that's more complicated and nuanced. And it's just not a skill that you learn, you know, when you go to school for science. All my schooling is in science, and the people skills was just not something that ever really was taught. But clearly, it's even in a pandemic. It's hard to get away from people. You're always dealing with people. And of course, you know, we've had our own mental struggles here. I have. When we bought the farm, we moved away 3-4 hours away from all of our family and friends. And so we had really no support network when we moved out here. But I think this will be extremely valuable because, and of course, it not only has implications for the farming aspect of my life, but of course, will have applications to just my personal everyday life as well.
Even pre-pandemic, how is farming for a woman in rural Wisconsin? How is that a little different? Do you think it is different than for a male or other counterpart? I mean, what are the stresses there, even pre-pandemic?
I think it's a little different. Obviously, I think men have a lot of stress, you know, also. So I don't want to, like, diminish that. In fact, I would say that my biggest stressors in my life growing up and everything, too, was men who were not dealing with their mental health issues in a healthy way. My dad died from drinking when he was 49 because he turned to a non-healthy form of coping with stress and mental health issues. So I don't want to diminish from the male aspect at all. But, you know, women tend to be caregivers, nurturers. We do take on that emotional load. And there's also, of course, the social media aspect. You know, you can always be skinnier and prettier and have better makeup skills and, you know, all the things on social media now. But we also have this guilt too, I think. I mean, I know I do. Like, I still feel guilty about hiring somebody to help me clean the house. I don't want people to know that I can't handle it all, right? And like I'm somehow being less than. But one of the things that I have kind of learned since we started the farm and learning the directions we wanted to take the farm is that the best thing that I can do, you know, is work in my strength. So where is the best place for me to be spending my time and money and energy? And then I try to not feel bad when I hire other people to use their strengths where I'm not strong. So that is kind of some of the big stuff that I've been learning as we've had the farm is I don't have to make my weaknesses strong. I can turn to other people to be more efficient where I'm not.
You know, I think Stephanie's touched on a lot of really important things, right? That we need connection, right? Like that's the number one thing that helps support and sustain our own good mental health and good coping skills. We need like me stories, right? So I don't feel so alone and I'm not constantly comparing myself to the Instagram perfect, right, version that people throw out there. And we need networks of support. And networks of support can include a lot of things like hiring for childcare, hiring for our houses to get clean, right? So that we really can focus on the places where our passions are and where our skill set matches what we want to be doing. There's no shame in that, right? Like we do make, I think, especially women feel guilty if they can't handle it all, like she mentioned. And it's simply unrealistic that women should be able to do all the childcare, all the elder care, all the house maintenance, all of the food preparation, and then go work an off-farm job or do their farming. No one person can do all of that, right? And so we have to get good at delegating and of, you know, helping to hire out labor where we can and where we need those supports. I really applaud Stephanie talking about healthy coping versus unhealthy coping skills. One of the country's leading agricultural psychologists is a man named Dr. Roseman out of Iowa. He's a farmer and psychologist and has been since the 1980s farm crisis. And he talks about how men frequently turn to anger and alcohol. That's what they've had modeled. That's what they've been taught, right? And that for everyone in ag, we need to do a better job of learning how to express hard emotions, learning how to develop those healthy coping skills, right? So that we have options beyond anger and alcohol as our way to cope with stressors. So I think programs like Comet can really be that first thing, hearing stories of other women of this is the challenge I'm facing. This is what I found to be effective, can be very effective for women to feel less alone. We're also finding that it can be effective when we're training men and male farmers to say, this is okay for you to talk about your emotions.
So find people like Stephanie will be trained, then they will be a resource for their area. How will they reach out to people or how will people in their region know that they're a resource? And will you be staying in touch with the Stephanie level people to see how they're doing?
So I do through FarmWell. We do offer a follow-up session or multiple follow-up sessions. We call them catch-up and connect sessions. So about a month after we train a group, we offer to bring them back together to have a conversation about how it's going, what questions have come up for them, where did they get stuck, do they have any additional thoughts or questions, and then we do some additional training on empathetic listening skills and get them to go a little bit deeper. So that will be an option for the women in conservation who get trained through us. And then it's really just sort of daily interactions, right? So they're not necessarily going to be advertised as a resource for their community, though they could be, but just individuals starting to like notice when people are stressed and struggling and having this new set of skills to reach out in a different way than they might have previously. The other thing we really encourage is networking between people who've gone through the workshop, right? Because there's no better way to help continue to normalize actually doing this kind of work and also providing support and resources for each other if the folks who get trained can have ongoing conversation with each other. That's really what it is. In my view, that's our task, is to do community capacity building. And we do that through creating these networks of ordinary people who can have conversations with each other over time to provide support.
Chris Frakes is the program director at FarmWell Wisconsin. Stephanie Schneider owns a farm in Western Wisconsin. They both spoke to WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. That first training takes place this weekend, and you can find out more information about it at WUWM.com. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction or thoughts of suicide, help is available at 800-273-8255. Ever heard of the Community Cafe? Well, coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll tell you about the idea behind the Taste of Lindsay Heights and meet some of the Milwaukee entrepreneurs who are turning their side hustle into a career there. But first, we'll get an update on how the Afghan refugees who came to Wisconsin are being resettled in the community. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's been a few months since the U.S. ended its 20-year war in Afghanistan, resulting in a Taliban takeover and evacuations of military personnel and Afghan citizens. Afghan refugees found themselves at army bases across the country and here in Wisconsin at Fort McCoy. Nearly 13,000 refugees were housed there at one point. Now, resettlement agencies are helping the refugees find more permanent homes. The State Department has approved 850 Afghans to be resettled in Wisconsin, with 400 of them coming to Milwaukee. Alexander Dertka is the president and CEO at the International Institute of Wisconsin. He says there are still a good number of people at Fort McCoy, but the Biden administration is hoping to have everyone resettled by February 15th. He spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver about that work.
We as an agency, from the International Institute standpoint, we have resettled approximately 175 individuals here in the greater Milwaukee area. Throughout the state in the various kind of settlements, they are also reaching their capacity. So we've all had kind of numbers in mind as to how many total individuals would be resettled through each agency, and especially here in Wisconsin. And that is something that the state is kind of overseeing as to what those numbers would look like. But there's quite a few yet to go. And I think it's important to point out is that we're not talking about just Afghan individuals, but we're also talking about the other individuals that will begin to resettle here in Wisconsin from other parts of the world.
And what are you hearing from the refugees that are being settled in Milwaukee? What are they telling you are their biggest hopes, their biggest concerns, their biggest fears, things like that?
Well, I think that it's their expectations, what their expectations are. And they're all over the map, if I could put it this way, in terms of, especially you have to understand, this Afghanistan was not just one place in Afghanistan, but it has a whole, it's a very large country, number one. And you have people who have come from different experiences. You have some from very urban kind of settings, some of people in the government and higher education and medical fields, etc. And then you have people who are out there in the field, you might say, who were in some distant province and might have served the U.S. in terms of being an interpreter for that particular kind of group. So their expectations are going to be very different. And so it is trying to, make those expectations realistic and to give them something that's very achievable.
I'm assuming if people have so much of that potential, if they've lived very full and rich lives in Afghanistan, obviously there are difficulties for women, there are difficulties living under the rule of the Taliban, having a country that was at war for much of the time. But if people are used to high levels of education, high levels of functioning in their society, I'm assuming there are things that agencies and people can do here to help them achieve those goals.
Well, it's working with them to get them, first of all, settled down here, to get some kind of roots here, to get them embedded within the community. And as you get embedded with the community, then these individuals can help very much in terms of branching out from there. But it's first get that person and those individuals settled here. And that means in terms of safe and affordable housing, for example. It might not be the greatest thing in the world, but it is something that they can count on. It's going to be there. They're safe. It's affordable for them as they move forward. Now, this all takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. And I think part of perhaps maybe we're seeing a certain amount of frustration on the part of the Afghans is because this happened back in what? End of September, October, November, when this whole process started. So they've been in this kind of transitory state, you know, from leaving their homeland, you know, to perhaps going to another place, then being placed in a camp, and then sitting there for a good period of time, and now being put out into the community. So there is a certain amount of frustration that is happening there. And we need to be aware of that and just kind of be able to talk about it. And talk about what their fears are, what their anxieties are, what their hopes, their dreams are. And with that particular kind of knowledge, we can kind of help them to move forward.
Beyond housing, what are some of the basics that people are needing? How are people adjusting with food, with the weather, with school, with learning the language, things like that?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, housing, the place is important. And those, as you know, are in short supply in terms of what's affordable. As we move forward, food, individuals have access to food, etc. But I think it's the next step after that, after you get them settled. And as like you're saying, for schools could be a whole nother thing. You have children. I mean, look at the frustrations that we have in terms of, especially during this COVID era. Are schools open? Are they closed? Are we doing virtual? Are we doing in person? Those kind of things. And then you get into all the linguistic kind of issues. In terms of how do you communicate, what's your ability to communicate to these individuals, to especially not only the children, but also to their parents? How do you make sure that they're getting the correct message? I know myself, you know, we have a mask mandate. What does that all mean? It's very difficult to work your way through. And if you're talking about individuals within a community helping, those are the kinds of things that they can help us with. That's very important to help us get through those kind of, I don't want to say barriers that might be there for them to become very, very much part of the community.
So people can help with social barriers, linguistic barriers, cultural barriers, things like that.
And also, like, for example, transportation. How do you get from point A to point B? I mean, if you asked me to do the bus route right now, I probably would have some very difficult times with that, navigating. So if you look at somebody new coming into the community, it's really helping them with those kind of things. Or like, for example, as one person said, you know, where do I go buy a goat? You know, it's something that they're very used to doing. Okay, well, there's no goat to be found here. Yes, in some instances, yes, down the line, you probably can. But for right now, where do you shop for food? Very simple kinds of things. And that's where volunteers and the community can really be of assistance in terms of taking some of these people under their wing and kind of walk them along. It's just like if we go to another country, we don't speak the language, the culture is totally different as to what people even eat. So what I'm going to be looking at is someone who can help me get through those small steps so that I can become very successful.
Well, how can people get in touch and get involved?
Well, they certainly can give us a call. You know, that's the International Institute of Wisconsin. Look on our website, iiwisconsin.org. And certainly there's a number of ways that people can volunteer. And we can move forward with that. And certainly we welcome any of the help that we can get. And I have to say, to date, people have been very generous with their help. But there's still much more to be done. No question about that. This is not an overnight thing. And there are still more individuals who will be coming from Afghanistan to the United States who will be seeking placement here, as well as other refugees from around the country, around the world, I should say, that have been put on hold during this period of time.
Alexander Dertka is the president and CEO at the International Institute of Wisconsin. He spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver. You can find more reporting on Fort McCoy at WUWM.com, including a look back at when Cuban refugees were housed there in the 1980s. We're continuing our COVID Earners series, where we learn about businesses owned and operated by people of color, who are reimagining our city's future during the pandemic. Taste of Lindsay Heights is a carryout cafe that is owned and operated by Walnut Way and its Community Wealth Building Campaign. The cafe features cuisines from residents in Lindsay Heights. And since its opening in October last year, the cafe supports six budding food entrepreneurs working to get their businesses off the ground. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang spoke with a few of them. Chandra Ellis opened Golden Honey Juice & Company and is the Community Wealth Building Coordinator with Walnut Way. Paula Bost is the owner of Rum Cakes by Paula, and Patricia Bent is the owner of Aunt Manda's Beverages.
It was developed around this mission to connect with the residents who live in Lindsay Heights and learn more about their side hustles and their passions and how we could connect those to opportunities and resources. And so there was an opportunity to reuse one of the commercial corridors on 16th and North Avenue, which had been closed for almost 2 years. And so many of the residents that we connected with had food side hustles. And it was a really strong group that were really driven. And so when I came along, things had kind of slowed down a bit, of course, because of COVID-19. And the community cafe idea was born out of just a desire to keep going and to keep pushing. We wanted to be a space that provided healthy, fresh foods for the residents who were now being affected by this virus. And then we also wanted to be an outlet and an incubator space for the entrepreneurs to be able to showcase their products and to be a support for them to launch into bigger endeavors.
And Paula, you've been a part of Taste of Lindsay Heights from the very beginning of the process, and now you run Rum Cakes by Paula at the cafe. How has your business evolved since the beginning of being a part of Taste of Lindsay Heights?
I've been baking for about 12 years. Initially, I didn't know if I wanted to be a part of it just because, you know, I was about to retire and wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But I'm actually very grateful that I'm a part of it. It's been a wonderful experience. There's some wonderful entrepreneurs that, you know, we're working with. You know, I'm happy to be a part of it. My business is growing, so it's definitely helping my business.
Taste of Lindsay Heights opened in October of 2021. Chandra, what has the community reaction been since you've all opened the storefront?
The community has been receiving us quite well. There's a lot of curiosity because the corridor was closed for so long. So a lot of folks stop by just because they're curious as to what's going on. And then it also has helped us with our community wealth building efforts to connect with more residents as well, because then their immediate reaction is, well, how can I get involved? How can I help? You know, I have a side hustle too I want to grow. So it's also helped us to be able to continue our community both building as well.
Paula and Patricia, you are both entrepreneurs in this space. What has the impact been for you all being at the cafe?
For me, you know, I have people who go into the cafe and I think my business cards and flyers are out there because I'm getting messages all the time about how pleased people are with the product. You know, how can they get more of it or buy a whole cake or buy a whole banana pudding? When the people from Real Milwaukee were in the cafe, I had one lady reach out to me right after just to say she saw it and she couldn't wait to try the cakes. And she has called me several times. She's placed several orders. So it's kind of cool that people see your product and they haven't necessarily tasted it yet, but they're anxious to be a part of, taste it. And I think she's been in the cafe several times. So she's gotten to taste some of all the products that, you know, the entrepreneurs have. So for me, that's exciting because it's not just my products. I mean, that's pretty cool.
You know, I went in one day and Chandra told me that, you know, because I'm from Jamaica, and my recipes are from my great-great-grandmother. So when I went in one day to drop off some of my beverages, she told me that there was a Jamaican in the store. And he was surprised to see ginger beer, you know, because a lot of places don't sell ginger beer. So he was surprised to see ginger beer in the refrigerator when I'm like excited because yes, we do have a lot of Jamaicans in the community, but I don't know them all. So it's kind of nice when a Jamaican can go in and see ginger beer and buy it and, you know, come back for more. So that was exciting to hear that, you know, Aunt Manda, and I'm sure that Jamaican is going to go spread the news to other Jamaican in the community that, hey, ginger beer is right here. Come and check it out. Because that's one of our favorite beverages from Jamaica, ginger beer. So that was exciting for me to know that one of my island person find my ginger beer and like it so much and he coming back for more.
And the pandemic has really pushed us to rethink about what our city's future could look like. And the pandemic has really reshaped what Taste of Lindsay Heights looks like, or it will look like, continue to look like. What are you hoping to reimagine in Milwaukee through your businesses and at Taste of Lindsay Heights at the cafe?
If I could start, my business, Golden Honey Juice and Co., is really based on a mission to provide fresh food, nutrient-dense products in our inner city, in the community, particularly the north and south side of Milwaukee, because there is a food inequity line when it comes to like fresh and really nutrient-dense products. Our grocery stores don't tend to hold the same level or quality fruits and vegetables that are on, you know, other sides of North Avenue. So what I would hope with this pandemic and what I've seen is that there are more people who are more vested and interested in their health and on how to be healthy and maintain their health. And also that we can reduce those inequities. So as people become more interested in being healthy, that our grocery stores and maybe corner stores start to provide more fresh ingredients. And that's what Golden Honey strives to do with our fresh juices and our ginger shots. I also hope that we start to lean on each other a little bit more, similar to how we've come together with the food cohort, the food entrepreneurs, that we are stronger together, that it's very hard to do things on your own, especially when you're trying to pivot in a pandemic or grow in a pandemic for your business. But when you have the ability to partner with folks and collaborate with them. So as Ms. Paula said, they come in for rum cake, but they might leave with a ginger beer or they might leave with cookies from another entrepreneur just out of, you know, the curiosity and getting into the space. So being able to share our audiences with each other and work together has really been a strength of ours. So my hope is that that would continue to grow as well.
I think one of the other things, and I agree with what Chandra has said, but, you know, hopefully, you know, we grow ourselves so that eventually we can employ individuals from within the Lindsay Heights community and, you know, provide job opportunities to those individuals. And I think for me, that's one of the keys to being a part of this whole process is we're able to give back to the community in some way as it relates to job employment opportunities.
Yeah, and you know, I totally agree with Chandra when it comes to working together, building each other up, helping each other. I know when I first started out, I was struggling to mentor each other, even mentor other people. I know when I started out, I'm a teacher as well. I used to take one of my students every summer and take that student with me and to just show them how to run a business, you know, how to make the juices and how to go out there and sell the juices. So I would like to get students involved, you know, teach them how to be an entrepreneur, show them how to be an entrepreneur. So for me, it's the mentoring of the younger generation.
Chandra Ellis operates Golden Honey Juice and Company and is the Community Wealth Building Coordinator with Walnut Way. Paula Bost is the owner of Rum Cakes by Paula, and Patricia Bent is the owner of Aunt Manda's Beverages. You can listen to past COVID earner segments at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, if you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts to hear us on demand. Coming up next, we'll learn how the fan favorite polka, I Love My Green Bay Packers, got an update. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Go Pack, go!
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Green Bay Packers will face the San Francisco 49ers in the NFC Divisional Playoff this Saturday at Lambeau Field. The two teams last met in Week 3, with the Packers pulling out a win after a walk-off field goal from Mason Crosby. Eddie J. Lemberger wrote and released I Love My Green Bay Packers back in 1993. Since then, it's become an unofficial fan-favorite theme song for the team. Now, the polka is bringing in some new fans with an update that still celebrates the green and gold. Lemberger collaborated with musician Jason Fabus and his band West Coast Prost to create an updated version of this classic song. They joined me last January to talk about it, and Lemberger starts by explaining how the song first came together.
When I first wrote the song in 1993, that was the first title I had, and then I thought, you know, this would be more powerful if I used, instead of the Green Bay Packers, my Green Bay Packers, because, of course, our Green Bay Packers are our team. You know, it's the greatest tradition in professional sports. And, you know, to have a professional team from a small city like Green Bay in a state like Wisconsin and have the great tradition that we have, it's something quite amazing. So, and we can all claim the Packers as our team. They're our team. And we love them. And I think Jason mentioned one time it's a tradition. It's a movement. The Green Bay Packers and our Green Bay Packers. Yeah.
Jason, you're from Milwaukee. You're currently living in LA, but obviously still a Packer fan out there. What kind of role has this song played in your world, and why did you want to team up to give it a little revamp here?
I first heard the song in the 96-97 season, which was when I was probably 8 years old and was a diehard Packer fan. And the team was doing very well that year, and this song kind of was a theme song for the team. Everybody rallied behind it. It was played on all the radio stations in Milwaukee where I was growing up, and I still remember it to this day. And for years now, as I've been getting older, I've been thinking I would like to, you know, do it again. I'd like to get in touch with Ed, and it's time to bring it back. And this year just really seemed to be the right time.
So you reached out to Ed and initiated this project?
Yeah, I used a really high technology way of getting in touch with him called Facebook.
Yes.
Yeah, I reached out to Ed on Messenger and gave him the idea, and I'm really glad that he took the message and received it well.
Yeah, Ed, what were you thinking? Were you like toying with the idea of on and off, or was this like a good springboard for you to be like, yeah, I guess it's time to do this again?
Well, I had thought about re-releasing I Love My Green Bay Packers for years. And Jason is such a great musician, and his band is so good. And I think this whole project, I think the song is in better shape than it's ever been. And that's thanks to Jason and his band. Very happy with the way everything happened. And it happened organically, kind of the same way that the I Love My Green Bay Packers song became a hit back in 1996. You know, I didn't even know all these radio and TV stations had the song, but things were happening to me synchronistically at the time.
No, I think it's very important that we talk about how you cranked up the polka. You know, Jason, despite as a jazz musician being your main form of what you're doing musically nowadays, living in LA, it certainly shows that you haven't forgotten how to polka.
Yeah, the polka band has been with me everywhere I go. We had one in Minnesota when I went to college there. I think that band is still playing out there. And then as I moved out to Los Angeles, I wanted to start a band out here. And it's a big part of Milwaukee tradition. And just like being a Packer fan is a big part of Wisconsin tradition, so is polka music. So we do it out here, and we do it on the West Coast. And there's a lot of people out here who may have never heard it before. So we're happy to bring it out here.
Your band is called West Coast Prost. And with a band like that, you'd assume your bandmates are maybe Midwesterners or and Packer fans. But did you have to convince any of them to don the green and gold and get into the project?
I did. When we were putting this together, we had to turn this whole project around in about 4 days, I think, Ed, right?
Yeah, something like that by the time we acted on it, yeah.
We got it done quickly, and I remember one day I was driving all around Los Angeles to each band member and dropping off Packers gear that I had. I had enough t-shirts and hats for everybody. We had to locate a cheesehead from another fan, so we got it done.
When you were both working on the revision of this song, what lyrics or components were easy to decide to keep in as essential, and what sections did you feel needed a little updating?
Well, I think the second verse has all the names, you know, dropped names of different celebrities to tell them that we love our group, that I love my Green Bay Packers, or we love our Green Bay Packers. And so we just updated all those. We went from Rush Limbaugh, tell that Rush Limbaugh, tell Hillary and Bill, and Oprah and Phil. We changed those to Kelly and Ryan and Meghan and Harry and Beyonce and Gaga, Miley C, things like that. We updated it. And then we went also with the Kardashians.
Yo, Eddie J, you know, we got Packers fans all over this great nation.
Hey, Jason, that's why our country is Packer Country USA.
Tell Kelly and Ryan, Beyonce, L and D.
Tell them what?
I love my Green Bay Packers.
And Bezos too.
I love my Green Bay Packers. I'll bet them Kardashians are secret Packer fans.
They look so dumb.
They know the best shellackers. So if you're green with envy, wear gold and perfect matches. That's why I love my Green Bay Packers.
You know, I mean, Kim and I, we share the same DNA, you know? Her father was Armenian and my mother Armenian, so... And then my father was European, so I thought we got to, you know, get some Armenian blood into this thing, even though I've got a Lemberger as a German last name. My father was German, so good old Kardashian Armenians.
Absolutely. So when you first wrote this original version in 1993, Eddie, how do you feel working on it again, reflecting on this song and going around touring with the Packers tailgate group? And now reintroducing it in a new way to everyone, and also, of course, virtually.
I think now I Love My Green Bay Packers is, you know, the premier sort of theme song, you know, unofficial theme song for the Green Bay Packers. And probably like I've been with this song for 28 years, you know, in 28 years, Jason's going to be, I'm not sure how old, but who knows? He might resurrect it back again, like long before I'm gone, you know, and the song will keep living on.
We are going to have to probably discuss doing a collaboration with Lil Wayne after he just released his Packers song as well. So,
okay, that would be great.
We'll wait for his call.
Yeah, we'll make him do some polka.
I told Lil Wayne on Twitter, and I'm sure that he never saw this, but I said, I like the new song, but it could use more tuba.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All these things you're mentioning are quintessential sounds of the Midwest that we're all used to. What do you think it is about this song that keeps it in such a special place?
I would say the lyrics are super catchy. The melody is very sweet. I was telling Ed Lemberger that the song is kind of like bread and butter. Everybody can attach to it and enjoys it. And that's why it doesn't get old. I think the lyrics we kept fresh, but the song itself has always been fresh. And polka music in general is just, it's joyous music. It's happy music. You cannot help but feel happy when you listen to it, no matter where you come from or what culture you're from. So You know, the accordion and the tuba are beloved instruments in our music.
And also in our Packer circles. So Jason and Eddie, I want to thank you both so much for joining me to talk about I Love My Green Bay Packers and Go Pack Go.
Go Pack Go.
Yeah. Thank you, Audrey.
Yes, we take our opposition and crunch them like they're crackers. That's why I love my Green Bay Packers. We got the best team. Go Pack!
Eddie J. Lemberger and Jason Fabus are the songwriters and musicians behind the updated re-release of I Love My Green Bay Packers. They joined me last January, and you can see the music video for the polka at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Beck Salgado, Chase Browning, and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Taryn Powell, Emily Files, Susan Bentz, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valerio Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn about Delta 8 THC and the loopholes that have made it legal in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.